All right. New unit, of course, but not a new system. We're still in the circulatory system. And this chapter has to do with the rest of the cardiovascular system within the circulatory system. The vessels themselves, of course, are part of the cardiovascular system. We've already talked about the heart. Now it's about the vessels. And in slide one, we can see a histological slide at the top of vessels. I'm sure you're already aware of what the major vessel types are, right? We've actually even talked about this in here already. How many types of vessels are there? Three major types, right? Veins, arteries, and capillaries. In the slide, in the micrograph of part A, we can see a vein and an artery for comparison histologically. We already covered what their functional difference is, right? Which is what? Right, they're defined based on direction of flow with respect to the heart, right? So arteries carry blood away from the heart, and they are therefore also called efferent vessels. Efferent means carrying away from, whereas veins are carry blood back to the heart, and they're called afferent vessels. So that we've already talked about, but when you compare what they actually look like, they differ as well. Typically, when you look at a cross-section, which we're doing here because this has been cut in such a way that the vein and the artery have both been cut transversely, so this is a cross-section with respect to those vessels. And when you look at an artery and a vein in cross-section, typically the artery will be roundish. It will maintain its shape and will have an open lumen still when you look at it on a slide. Whereas a vein, as you see here, is pretty much collapsed. It doesn't hold its shape well. Or if you look at an entire dissected human, if you look at a cadaver, the arteries are obvious compared to the veins that run right next to them, at least when we're talking about the large arteries and the large veins, because the arteries will maintain their roundness even though there's no more blood pumping through them, simply because of the stuff that makes up their walls. Whereas the veins will be flattened by comparison in a cadaver. So the veins are kind of like the hoses that are for emptying swimming pools that are just collapsed flat until the water's flowing through them. They open up easily, though, when the water comes, just like veins open up easily when there is blood pushing through them. On the other hand, an artery is more like a garden hose. Even when the water's turned off, it maintains its roundness because of that thick wall that it has. So yeah, those are the three major kinds, and capillaries, of course, are the smallest of the three. And also, as far as structure is concerned, or as far as placement in the body, capillaries are interposed between the other two types. Right? In other words, capillaries join arteries to veins. What else is special about capillaries? What's the big deal about capillaries? Yeah, that is where exchange of materials takes place between the blood that's in those capillaries and the tissues that the capillaries are running through. So that's really the most important part, right? As far as the function of the circulatory system is concerned, it doesn't exist as a function just to pump blood around continuously. You know, that does the body no good. The only reason the blood does the body good is because here and there it's able to make exchanges between the blood and the surrounding tissues. If you didn't have that happen, it would be a useless fluid being just pumped around at the expense of energy for nothing. Well, that exchange doesn't take place over all of the sections of tubing. Exchange doesn't take place at the arteries. The arteries are sealed off. They're just tubes for conducting this blood from the heart to the smaller arteries to the smallest arteries, which we call arterioles, and then finally to the capillaries. It's not until the blood gets to the capillaries where exchange takes place. And I'm talking not only about gaseous exchange, so drop off of of oxygen to the tissues if it's in the systemic circuit, and a pickup of CO2 that those cells have produced meanwhile. That occurs, of course. But also exchange of other particles, like nutrients and hormones, metabolic wastes other than CO2. Those get exchanged with the blood at capillaries as well. To a lesser extent, there is also some exchange possible at the smallest of the veins. Just like the smallest arteries are called arterioles, the smallest veins are called venules. And the smallest of those venules, which would be the smallest of the smallest veins, the ones that are the very first venules, the ones that are come right after the capillaries, those also have some exchange taking place on them, but most of the exchange takes place at capillaries. So capillaries are really the reason that the circulatory system works for the various functions it performs. And the bottom is just a micrograph showing capillaries joining these arterioles and venules. So this artery and this vein, which look huge in this picture, that's just because this is such a close-up view. This artery is a tiny artery. It's the smallest of the arterioles, and this vein is the smallest of the venules because they are directly connected to the capillaries. The capillary connects the arteriole to the venule. Capillaries are microscopic. And so obviously they aren't named. There are millions and millions of capillaries throughout the body. And every single cell in the body is either directly in contact with a capillary or only a few cells away. That is to say, the living cells of the body, I should say. For instance, the epidermis is made up of a bunch of layers of dead cells. At least the outer layers of the epidermis are dead. So it doesn't matter that those cells are fairly far away from a blood supply. They don't need blood to be dead. But the living cells of the body, for reasons I've already talked about, they need to be able to get rid of waste and to take in nutrients and O2. If diffusion is going to do that job, that means they need to be close to where that source is, or where that sink is if they're dumping stuff the other way. So diffusion can happen over distances of a few cell diameters, and that's about how far away any cell is at any given time from a capillary. So the number of capillaries throughout the body is enormous, but they're microscopic individually. All right, to slide 2, let's look at these different size classes of these various kinds of vessels. So you have veins on the left of this figure and arteries on the right. Well, there are 3 major size classes within each of these 2 major non-capillary vessels. If we start at the heart, we should talk about arteries first. So let's look at the right side of this. The largest of the arteries can be called large arteries. That's pretty self-descriptive. But an interchangeable word of that is conducting arteries. And they actually can go by a third name, which is not listed here. The large arteries can also be called elastic arteries. Now, I actually, before I started talking about one specific class, I should have said that all of these arteries and veins, regardless of their size, and it was labeled in the previous slide as well on the micrograph, all of the vessels, other than the capillaries, have three layers that make them up. And you see them listed here as well. Notice that in the previous slide they were listed up on the top. Tunica interna, tunica media, and tunica externa. Or they're labeled here again. So all of these size classes have all three of those layers. But how thick each layer is and what it's made up of primarily differs from size class to size class. Well, why are they called tunica interna, tunica media, and tunica externa? Well, interna means internal, obviously. External, external. And media means in between. A tunic is a coat, right? If you think of it in wardrobe terms. So you have an internal coat, an intermediate coat, and an external coat. Well, the tunica interna, as you see up here in the upper right, consists of the endothelial cells, a single layer of cells that make up the innermost part of the vessel, whether it's an artery or a vein, or a capillary for that matter. Even a capillary has an endothelial layer of cells. That is the layer of cells that is in direct contact with the blood. So the lumen is simply the space formed by this one layer of cells forming a tube, and that one layer of cells is an endothelium. Endothelium is just a special case of epithelium, right? It's epithelial as far as histology is concerned. It's not muscular, nervous, or connective. It's epithelial cells. But we call it an endothelium simply because it's an internal lining rather than an external lining like the epidermis is. Anyway, that's where the blood is directly exposed to. And those endothelial cells, and I talked a little bit about this in the heart chapter, or in the blood chapter, I mean. Those endothelial cells don't interact with the blood. In fact, they kind of repel the blood. So, blood does not stick to healthy, uninjured, uninflamed endothelial cells of the vessels. How I mentioned this in the blood chapter was in terms of hemostasis. When there is an injury, you have a breach in that lining, that endothelial lining, so that platelets are exposed to what is the next layer, more superficial. Superficial, by the way, here means away from the lumen, right? So if you have a hole in that endothelial lining, that next layer is connective tissue made up of collagen and other stuff. When platelets are exposed to that, that's what spurs them into forming a platelet plug, because they know there's a hole. But normally the platelets don't interact with the endothelial lining. And by the way, that endothelial layer, which is part of the tunica interna of the vessels, that is continuous with the endothelial lining in the heart, which we call what? The endocardium, right. Endocardial cells are continuous with endothelial cells of the vessels. And just like blood doesn't interact with them in the vessels, they don't interact with the endocardial cells, which is an epithelium. All right, but like any epithelium anywhere in the body, the cells that make up the epithelium, which are the epithelial cells, have to have something they're built on, which is called a basement membrane in all cases. So any epithelium has cells and a basement membrane. The basement membrane is really made up mostly of connective tissue, even though we count it as part of the epithelium, which is a different kind of tissue. Well, that's the other part of the tunica interna. And that would be superficial, which would mean toward the outside of the vessel compared to the endothelial cells, which are in direct contact with the blood. That's what really holds those cells in place. It's a thin layer, though, of basement membrane. And so that's pretty much the same in all of these size classes of vessels. Okay, that's the tunica interna. The tunica media, which is the next superficial layer, it's outside of the tunica interna, varies quite a bit depending on what kind of vessel you're in, whether it's artery or vein, and which type, which size class of artery or vein. And I told you a little bit ago that conducting arteries, which can also be called large arteries, can also be called elastic arteries, and that's because the main thickness of the tunica interna, the tunica media, in that case, is elastic tissue, allowing these things to expand, but then recoil into their original diameter. So these things are called conducting arteries because their main job is to just get blood to other arteries, to conduct it to other arteries. They're called elastic arteries because they are the closest ones to the heart, right? The largest arteries are actually the largest vessels in general, whether they're arteries or veins, are closest to the heart. The largest arteries are the ones that receive blood directly from the heart, and they, by being closest to the heart, they experience the greatest pressure from the heart, the greatest blood pressure. If you have something causing pressure in a fluid that's in a tube, whatever is pressurizing that fluid, the pressure will be decreased the farther away from that source you get, unless you have perfectly rigid walls, which you don't have in the circulatory system. So the conducting arteries, the large arteries, like aorta, for instance, or the pulmonary trunk, those are the largest of the large arteries. Those receive the greatest force that the blood is applying to their walls because of the contraction of the heart. And they need to be able to absorb some of that energy by expanding so that stress of adding pressure each heartbeat is decreased for the downstream smaller arteries. The fact that these large arteries are able to be elastic saves the health of the smaller arteries. And as a result, those smaller arteries don't experience nearly as much amplitude or maximum to minimum pressure that they would receive if you had rigid-walled aorta, for instance, because they balloon out because of this elasticity. And go ahead.
How does the tunica interna expand if it's just a single layer of cells?
Because the thickness of the cell becomes thinner.
Okay.
And that's the major way. They can also kind of overlap a little bit, like in transitional epithelium, but I think that's a minor component. So this elastic expansion, when they're stretched because the ventricles have just contracted, that balloons out the largest of the arteries, aorta and pulmonary arch, but also the other large arteries. And then the ventricle contracts, so the force is no longer being applied from the heart. The elastic recoil that happens in these large arteries then squeezes on the blood. And so that means downstream of them, the smaller arteries first of all, don't have as high a pressure during contraction because that some of that pressure goes into just expanding the large arteries. And then when the heart is relaxed, since there's elastic recoil by the large arteries, that squeezes the blood forward, and therefore the minimum pressure doesn't go as low as it would in those downstream arteries. So the pressure becomes more constant in this set of tubes the farther away you get from the heart. And that's an important part of the elastic arteries, is that it takes the brunt of this of these large changes in pressure every heartbeat. So you have a tunica media in all of these size classes, but what makes it up is different. In the next smaller arteries, which are called either distributing arteries or medium arteries or muscular arteries, the reason for that third possible name, which all of which are interchangeable, is that a large part of the tunica media is smooth muscle. And so muscle, of course, works by contracting. The smooth muscle that's in the tunica media allows for adjustment of the diameter of the vessel. By contraction or relaxation, you can either vasoconstrict or vasodilate, respectively. So there is a degree of smooth muscle in all of the arteries, but much more so in medium arteries than large arteries, and that's why they're called, instead of elastic arteries, muscular arteries, as one of their names. The smallest arteries are the arterioles, and they don't have names. By the time you're getting this small, because keep in mind that arteries branch. You go from one big one to several smaller ones, and then from those, several more smaller ones, and so on. By the time you get to the arterial size, there's so many of them that it's not only would it be a bitch to learn all those names, but it doesn't make sense to name them because by then they're not in the same places in each human. There's a lot of variability. So they're not given names. And whereas the large arteries and the medium arteries are. There's even some variability in those. Not everyone has the same named artery in exactly the same place or with exactly the same kind of branching. There's variability from human to human. But they have those bigger ones have names. Arterioles don't. And, you know, this is not a clean jump from one size class to the other. It's a continuum of sizes, really, that we artificially put it into three size classes. But the smallest of the arterioles are the most distal ones. That distal here means farther from the heart in terms of the flow of blood, not necessarily distance from the heart directly to the arterial, but you know what I mean. The most distal arteries are the ones that are the last ones to be called arteries before you get to that capillary. So the most distal of the arteries, the smallest ones, are called precapillary arteries, arterioles. Because the next thing is going to be a capillary, which is a different kind of vessel, and even smaller. Okay, the capillaries themselves we'll talk about separately in a slide. They, though, do not have all of these three tunics. The capillaries need to be as thin as possible to make diffusion as efficient as possible. So they have, in most cases, nothing but an endothelial layer, a single layer of cells making up the endothelium, and that basement membrane, which itself is very thin. All right, that's where most of the exchange takes place, like I said. Then you need to bring blood back to the heart, and that's through veins. Well, the smallest of the veins, if you think of three size classes, are venules. But the smallest of those venules are the ones that capillaries directly lead to. So the venule, the smallest venules, the post-capillary venules, are the ones that directly pick up blood after that blood has flowed through a capillary. You get into medium veins then, of course, and then large veins before you're back to the heart. But notice that in medium veins, back up for a second. Arterioles aren't named, neither are venules, for the same reason. Medium veins do get names, though, mostly either where they are in the body or what organ they're draining is what they're named for, usually. But notice that there's something in medium veins that we don't find in the other vessels. And those are these little flaps of tissue that protrude into the lumen and act as valves. So medium veins have valves. And a valve, by definition, is something that allows flow in one direction only, right? Just like the valves of the heart. Well, the reason that we need valves in these medium veins is because pressure drops the farther you get away from the heart. And by the time you've already gone through a capillary bed and you're now in the veins, pressure is very low. That low pressure isn't sufficient to drive that blood in one direction continuously back to the heart, especially in veins that are often positioned vertically, like in the legs, for instance. If you stand up for a long time, the veins in the legs, which are positioned vertically at that time, are filled with blood that gravity is trying to push in the opposite direction. And the pressure, which is so low by that point, that it's not enough to overcome gravity consistently. So it would basically be moving up and down with the heartbeat if it weren't for these valves. The valves don't push it forward. It's just that the valves close when gravity tries to move it backwards, move the blood backwards. It closes on the valves, so it just keeps it from moving backwards. What propels it forward is the fact that there is some blood pressure, even though it's low, but also the veins are being squeezed from outside by contraction of skeletal muscles. So if you imagine a vein as a tube right by a whole muscle, a skeletal muscle, that skeletal muscle will also have its grain, or at least some of them will have their grain in parallel with the vein, right? In other words, the direction of contraction of the skeletal muscle is going to be the same axis as the direction of flow of blood through the vein. Well, what happens when a long, relaxed skeletal muscle contracts? It doesn't change its mass, right? It doesn't get smaller. It just gets shorter. It still has the same volume. So in order for it to be shorter, it's going to have to get wider at the same time. And that's going to push from the side on the wall of the vessel, the vein. This helps kind of like a second heart. This is called the skeletal muscle pump, as a matter of fact, because it will push blood through those veins by causing them to collapse. And if you only had that pushing with the skeletal muscles, without the valves, then it would just as likely push it in the wrong direction. The valves ensure that when the skeletal muscles push on the veins, the blood is pushed toward the heart only. Okay, so the largest of the veins are things, they're also named, and those are ones that we've already talked about in a couple of instances. The ones that directly attach to the heart, of course, are the largest veins, superior and inferior veni cavae, and the pulmonary veins. Those are the largest of the large veins. Okay, let's go to three. Look at the heart again, not for the sake of studying the heart this time, but actually for what's happening at and around the heart on the vessels. There are two major kinds of receptors located in various places that are important for controlling not only heart rate, but breathing rate as well. There are two things that really need to be controlled that use these receptors, and that's blood pressure and also blood pH. So there are two fundamentally different kinds of receptors being used here. Baroreceptors are receptors that respond to changes in pressure. Baro means pressure. Same root as in barometer, which is a measure of atmospheric pressure. All right. But there are also chemoreceptors, which of course respond to the presence or absence of certain chemicals. The baroreceptors are in charge of regulating blood pressure, or at least of monitoring it as part of regulating it. And the chemoreceptors are there to monitor pH, mostly. Well, baroreceptors are examples of mechanoreceptors. Remember these terms from 201? Mechanoreceptors work by what means in general? What causes mechanoreceptors to fire, to create an action potential? Deformation, being deformed in some way. The shape gets changed by some force. Well, in the case of baroreceptors, they are mechanoreceptors that respond to being stretched. And so the baroreceptors are housed in the walls of some of the largest arteries. Notice that there are baroreceptors in the wall of the aortic arch. That makes perfect sense because the aortic arch is the thing that balloons out the most. It's an elastic artery. It balloons out quite a bit because it's receiving pressure directly from the heart. And so how much it stretches each beat tells the body continuously what the current blood pressure is. It's not the only baroreceptor, though. You also have baroreceptors in making up what are called, in what are called the carotid sinuses. Now, the carotid arteries are important arteries that go to the head. They're really important because they, one of the things that they serve blood to is the brain. You have a common carotid artery on either side, but that common carotid artery at the jaw, basically, branches into an internal and an external carotid artery. So you have a right and left version of an internal and an external. The internal carotid arteries go to the brain, and right after the branch that the common carotid artery undergoes to become the internal and external, and you see it only on the left one right here. Oh, sorry, the right one. There's another version, though, on the left. Anyway, at that branch point is where you find the baroreceptors on the carotid arteries. And that particular place is called a carotid sinus simply because it has a bigger lumen than the rest of the artery. Remember, a sinus is an open space. Okay, well, that's doing the same thing. It's just measuring in a different place. So if they stretch too much, that tells the brain that blood pressure is too high right now, and therefore you need to use a negative feedback mechanism to bring it down. Or if it's too low, the opposite. Chemoreceptors, on the other hand, are located also at the aorta, but it's a distinct set of receptors, of course. These are called aortic bodies if they're in the aorta, for obvious reasons. But there are also chemoreceptors very close to the carotid sinus, but in the other branch of the carotid artery, the common carotid artery, and those are called carotid bodies. Now, these, I said, respond mainly to changes in pH, which is a very important thing to maintain its steady state, right? Because you change pH, you don't even have to change it very drastically, and you start changing the shape of proteins. Proteins lose their function if they change their shape, and that can quickly kill you. So blood pH is maintained pretty tightly. It's monitored, though, by these chemoreceptors in the carotid bodies and the aortic bodies. Here's how it works, though. Did I already talk about the buffering system? I mean, I know I did in cell bio, but have I in 201? How CO2 and water come? Okay. CO2 and water, let me just quickly go over this. Carbon dioxide and water can combine chemically to form what? Carbonic acid, which is what? What is the symbol? H2CO3, right? That's carbonic acid. It doesn't stay as carbonic acid very, very long, though. It will then dissociate, as acids do, into, I should make these double arrows, hydrogen ion. That's what an acid is. It's something that can give a hydrogen ion off when it's in the presence of water. And what's left of the carbonic acid, which is minus. Okay, what is HCO3 minus called? Bicarbonate ion. That's its old-fashioned name that we're still using. Or hydrogen carbonate, but it's bicarbonate. The bicarbonate ion is what that is. Well, anyway, this happened. This whole reaction, even though it's reversible, will proceed to the right if you add one of these left products, right? That's by Le Chatelier's principle. This is why when you hold your breath, you eventually have to breathe. A lot of people think that you run out of oxygen. That's not really what's happening. When you hold your breath, the cells of the body in the systemic circuit are still undergoing cellular respiration and therefore producing CO2. They're dumping that into the blood. The blood is being brought back to the lungs because the heart's still beating, but you're no longer ventilating since you're holding your breath, so that CO2 is not being lost. It's building up in the blood. So that's the same as adding more and more CO2 to this reaction. So it reacts with the blood water to form carbonic acid, which then splits into hydrogen ions and bicarbonate ions. Well, those hydrogen ions acidify the blood, which means the pH falls. That's what these carotid bodies and aortic bodies are sensitive to, exquisitely sensitive. A tiny drop in pH is really what sends a signal to your brain that I don't care what your intentions are, I'm going to force you to breathe. You still have plenty of oxygen at that point. It's the tiny buildup of CO2 that acidifies the blood that causes that. And on the other hand, if you force yourself to hyperventilate, what you're doing really is blowing off more CO2 than your cells are producing, which is bad in the opposite direction. That's going to force this by Le Chatelier's principle to the left. You're getting rid of too much CO2, that's going to force this everything to go to the left to make up for that CO2, which means hydrogen ions are going to combine with bicarbonate ions to form carbonic acid, which then splits into CO2 and H2O. That's going to take hydrogen ions out of solution, which makes the blood less acidic. The pH will go up. That will also be sensed by the carotid bodies and the aortic bodies. So that's why their chemoreceptors that are responding to a certain chemical. Okay, now to 4. This is a close-up view of one type of capillary. There are 3 major kinds of capillaries. The first, shown here, is called a continuous capillary. In Canada, they're called continuous capillaries. Either is fine. They're the vast majority of capillaries. Most capillaries are continuous capillaries. And they're called continuous mainly because they don't have all that many holes in them. They form a continuous tube. unbroken tube. But I already told you that a lot of exchange takes place at capillaries, so things get into and out of the blood at continuous capillaries. It's just that they aren't as full of holes as the other types of capillaries are. So they're called continuous capillaries. We're looking at a cross-section of a continuous capillary here, and you can see that they are just about as thin as they can be to promote efficient diffusion between the blood and the tissues. So there is the single layer of cells called the endothelium. Those are these yellow cells. And then a very thin basement membrane superficial to that that keeps them together, basically, as a layer. Where adjacent but separate endothelial cells meet, you typically have intercellular clefts, which are little gaps. So even though we call these continuous capillaries, there are some small holes in them. And these intercellular clefts allow for small things, glucose for instance, to pass through, but not very big things. So proteins, plasma proteins and other proteins are way too huge to get through these. There are also tight junctions between epithelial cells, and that blocks the passage of most things. And in certain places in the body, you wouldn't even have these intracellular clefts, like in the brain, for instance. If you had intracellular clefts in the continuous capillaries of the brain, then you wouldn't have what's called the blood-brain barrier. Right? So that would be, you wouldn't have those in the brain, but in most places in the body, you do have these intracellular clefts. Now, this cell that's shown on the exterior surface, this parasite, and that's parasite, not parasite, like something that lives in you. These are cells that are set up very much like muscle cells. And so they're thought to contribute to capillary vasodilation or vasoconstriction. But also they are stem cells of sorts, because if they need to, they can develop into either muscle cells or endothelial cells, like after an injury, for instance, to heal it. But you don't find them continuously. That's shown in here as a picture, just as a catch-all cartoon, basically. Now, the red blood cell that's in here, in the lumen, actually isn't being too stressed by this part of the continuous capillary. The diameter of a continuous capillary changes, though, and at its narrowest point, which is about 5 micrometers maybe in diameter, that diameter is smaller than the diameter of a typical erythrocyte, which is about 7 micrometers. And so, and that's not here. This is a wider part of the capillary, but where it's at its narrowest point, that erythrocyte, that red blood cell, actually has to deform its shape to squeeze through that tube that's smaller than its own diameter. This, though, even though that's hard on the erythrocyte, and that's one of the reasons they wear out, like I was talking about, it also puts them in direct contact with the wall and makes it even better as far as efficiency of exchange of oxygen and carbon dioxide is concerned. All right, so that's one class of capillary. The next is shown in slide 5. This next kind of capillary is called a fenestrated capillary. And I'll write this in light gray for you, Sam. The farthest people. I know this one's on its last leg, but this is how you spell fenestrated. Anyone know what that means? Do you know the word defenestrate, the verb defenestrate? To defenestrate means to throw out an open window. Yes, they have a word just for that. The German word for window is Fenster. So fenestrated means full of windows, literally. Well, these windows are little clefts, pores. You have clefts in these as well, but the fenestrations are the actual pores, which are bigger gaps in the wall of the capillary compared to the clefts. And so you don't have fenestrated capillaries throughout the body. There's major places where you do have them, including the kidney, which is an important thing for filtration, right? So where you have to have a greater flow of things out of the bloodstream, a greater escape route for hormones, for instance, so you also find fenestrated capillaries at glands, endocrine glands, which are secreting these hormones. Those hormones need to make it into the bloodstream. They can make it into the bloodstream more easily through fenestrations. So the capillaries that surround endocrine glands tend to be fenestrated. But anyway, it's not the typical capillary. The typical capillary in a typical tissue being served are the continuous capillaries. So that's the second class, and it would be more leaky than the first class. The most leaky, though, of all the capillaries are the third class, which we see in slide 6. And these are called the sinusoids. Now, sinusoid literally means like a sinus, and we've already talked about the fact that a sinus is a comparatively enlarged space. Well, just like the fenestrated capillaries, you don't find these just anywhere in the body. The main places where you find sinusoids are in the liver, which is what this cartoon is an example of. Also in the bone marrow and the spleen as well. I'm not saying those are the only three places, but those are the three main places where you have sinusoids. And so there's not really a well-defined tube-like shape to them. They're just spaces that blood is flowing through in that area. And notice that they are anything but continuous. They're the opposite of continuous. There are endothelial cells, but notice that there's major spaces between the endothelial cells. So that's what makes the sinusoids by far the leakiest of the capillary types. It makes sense in the liver for there to be sinusoids because of the many functions that the liver performs. What is its major function with respect to the blood? Well, yeah, that involves the blood as well. But what I was looking for is that, as far as the makeup of the blood is concerned, what is the liver's contribution? It produces the plasma proteins. Almost all the plasma proteins are produced by the liver. So albumins, globulins, those things come from the liver cells. Well, these are big proteins. Proteins in general are big molecules. They can't get through small spaces. So the liver is able to get these proteins that it produces into the plasma through these major gaps between endothelial cells. All right, and it also makes sense in bone marrow because of what we already talked about. When platelets are formed, remember you had that megakaryocyte squeezing through a gap in a sinusoid, and then just the flow of the blood shears off little pieces of it that become platelets. So it makes sense there too, as well as other kinds of blood cells entering the bloodstream there. That's where blood cells are born, right? Cells are big. They're even bigger than proteins, so they need wide spaces to get into the bloodstream from the marrow at which they're produced. All right, I better stop there since we're at the end of slide 6.